This is Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Yes,
yeah,
just one.
Perfect, just that one sandwich. Yeah. All right, can I just have a name for your...
It's lunchtime at Dune Restaurant in LA's Atwater Village neighborhood. Back in the kitchen, a team of about a half dozen chefs and staff hustle to fill orders. Hummus plates, falafel wraps, and other staples from the Levant. Like many businesses in LA, this restaurant has taken extra precautions during the last 15 months, you know, COVID. Tables are set up on the sidewalk patio. Customers cannot enter the building. You order over an intercom. And the only payments accepted here are either electronic or plastic.
We are a very high-volume restaurant, and for a customer to be fluffing around with their wallet and maybe some even trying to give you the precise change, if you can just tap your phone, you know, you're done, you're out, you know, and we can attend to the next customer.
That's Simon Pond, the operations manager here. He says the restaurant ditched cash based on guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last year. At the time, that decision was based on safety, but there have been operational benefits as well. And so, this restaurant is among a fast-growing segment of the U.S. economy that's getting rid of paper money entirely. But what about people without credit cards? KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb covers the business of Southern California. He's been watching this trend for a couple of years now and is with us right now. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
I am noticing more and more businesses not accepting cash. You see the signs. Is this really common, or at least more common now around L.A.?
Yes, Stephen, you're not the only person who's noticing that more businesses just aren't taking cash. I mean, it's all over the city. I'll give you one of the biggest examples, Dodger Stadium. You can't use cash there to buy a ball cap or a hot dog. The team has actually gone so far to install cash for card machines inside Dodger Stadium for folks who've left their cards behind or don't have one. And there's other popular chain stores as well. Yogurtland, for example, they've gone cash-free during the pandemic. And all of this adds to the growing number of businesses that did this before COVID-19. Sweetgreen being among one of the best-known places to do this as well. It's really become a trend, Steve.
So a trend. Is it a national trend, or are we talking about just Southern California?
It's a national trend, and there are some numbers to back it up as well. There's this recent report by the digital payment company Square. You know, Square is that company. They have this product where there's this little tiny white box, and you can swipe your credit card. Well, Square found that the number of businesses that use its service and no longer accept paper currency, it's actually doubled in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and the U.K. since February of last year.
It doubled?
Yeah, it doubled. So it was around 9% before. And if you look at Square's customer base nationally here in the U.S., now it's about 18% of businesses that have actually gone cashless. So this is fastly growing, right? But it's not the majority. But it does include a restaurant in Atwater that we just heard from, Dune Restaurant, which started to do this because of the pandemic. But it turns out, Pond says it's been great for business operations too.
You don't have to count cash drawers. You don't have to switch out, cash drawers, you know, midway through the day. You don't need to do bank runs.
And Steve, what we've seen across Los Angeles in particular is this cashless trend is now on hyperdrive. That's according to Shelley Santana. She's a professor at Bentley University in Massachusetts and also an expert on the cashless economy.
If you look at the trends overall and where we were headed from a cashless perspective, the pandemic took 3 years off of the timeline for us to like move forward in this transition. So we got to where we are today 3 years faster than we would have gotten had it not been for COVID-19.
How do customers feel about this, Benjamin? The people who are buying things? I mean, do they prefer using credit over cash? And is it even available to some people?
Yeah, Steve, I mean, that's a really important question. And the simple answer is it depends on the customer, right? I mean, I'll give you a little sample. Generally, there's a younger, tech-savvy clientele that really likes this. They don't normally carry cash anyway, so the transition to, say, a cash-free business like Dune, it's not a big deal. That includes folks like James Stomber, who stopped in for a bite at Dune Restaurant recently.
It's not a problem to me. If it's something that benefits them, then I'm happy to do it. All I understand is inconvenience to some.
Do you often carry cash with you?
No, almost never.
Then you've got an older generation that's just not used to throwing down the credit card for a small transaction, right? I mean, a $4 coffee, throwing down the plastic, it doesn't make much sense. And that includes someone that I met outside as well at Dune. Her name is Fern Laurel. Take a listen.
It's our currency, and everything being digital and electronic and, you know, being out there constantly using it, I do feel a little bit vulnerable.
Vulnerable to fraud, vulnerable about, you know, losing her privacy. Those are some concerns from older customers generally. For others, during the pandemic, this practice is fine, but afterwards, they would have an issue with it. And that includes someone I met outside as well. His name is Kevin Hawken. And his reason has to do with equity and access, right? Does someone have a smartphone? Does someone have a credit card? These are concerns for Hawken.
It's an elitist move. It's totally classist. And I think at some point you have to accept cash. But I think while we're coming out of a pandemic or still very much in a pandemic, I think it is a great solution and acceptable.
So that last voice, Benjamin, is I asked you before, you know, it's not obviously available to everyone, the credit card thing, the smartphone thing. Not everybody has money. Not everybody has great credit. Apple Pay, all those other things. What's been the response from local governments? And will the federal government, do you think, get involved?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Let's start with the city of Los Angeles, okay? A couple years ago, when I first started reporting on this issue, the city of LA had no official position on cashless transactions at all. Fast forward to a couple weeks ago, things are much different. Recently, I actually caught up with LA Mayor Eric Garcetti, and he's firmly bought into the cashless future, he says. And he also wants to make sure that Angelenos are ready for it.
I think the forces predate the pandemic to be contactless and electronic, and we've got to make sure that everybody has access to that. So it's one of the reasons we started LA Optimize, to go to 1,000 businesses, usually in our blacker and browner neighborhoods, where it might be an immigrant business or an African-American entrepreneur who's never had a social media presence, doesn't connect to digital marketing, and certainly didn't know how to take a cashless payment. We're going to go and do that work for free with them so that they can lead the way.
You heard the mayor mention that program, LA Optimize. It's really born out of the pandemic, helping businesses adjust to that. But it's akin to this cashless transaction trend as well, because as we've seen prior to the pandemic, some businesses have been going toward this cash-free model. But that's not how other cities and states have gone, Steve, right? For example, the New York City Council passed an ordinance last year that requires businesses to allow cash transactions. Okay, so a business in New York City, they cannot ban cash. San Francisco and Philadelphia did the same thing a couple years ago. And both of those cities pointed to equity issues, right? The question of whether or not you have access to a bank account or a credit card. I should point out some of these rules have been relaxed during the pandemic and they haven't been enforced. Now, as for the federal government, there's actually talk right now of the Fed developing a U.S. digital coin, kind of akin to like a Bitcoin. And they've teamed up, the Fed has, with MIT to think about how to make central bank digital currencies. So it's a way, way new frontier, Steve. If you ask the experts, they say we're well on our way there. I do want to be clear, though, cash is just not done yet, right? Shelley Santana at Bentley University says that she's been impressed with the paper dollar and its staying power. But I will say, she did warn me, be prepared for more and more places in your neighborhood to tell you, sorry, we just don't accept cash.
Unless maybe a poker game or something like that, right?
That's right.
KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb reporting for us. Benjamin, thanks.
Anytime, Steve.
Well, here's something that you don't want to gamble with, and that is your public radio station. KCRW's Drive to the Future provides essential support to KCRW, of course, and makes all of our news and cultural and music programs possible. And right now, we're sharing your donations with community organizations in the greater LA area, focusing on housing and public health and education, three issues that came into stark focus during the pandemic. So today, part of your contribution will go toward an organization called Heart of Los Angeles, or OLA for short. It provides underserved kids with after-school programs, including academics, arts, athletics, wellness, all at no cost to the family. So think about that. Think about the local coverage you require every day, be it cashless businesses or maybe even a COVID update, homelessness. Where do you turn? If the answer is KCRW, donate today. kcrw.com/give. Don't wait. We're in the final stretch. Less than a week to go. Give now at kcrw.com/give. And thank you so much for your support of Public Radio.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Police now are investigating an attack last night of a group of Jewish men as a possible hate crime. It happened at a restaurant in the Beverly Grove area where witnesses say three men shouting slurs punched the diners and threw bottles at them. No one was seriously injured. Eyewitnesses say the attackers may have been a part of a pro-Palestinian caravan traveling through the neighborhood, but there's been no confirmation of that as of right now. It's yet another example of how tensions over what's happening in the Middle East between Israelis and Palestinians are very, very high, and that obviously extends to the communities here in Los Angeles as well. Let's talk about it. Elad Masuri is an Israeli journalist based in Los Angeles. Elad, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
And Rilla Selbach is an L.A.-based filmmaker of Palestinian descent. Thank you for being with us, too, Rilla.
Absolutely. No, thank you.
Elad, I want to start with you. You moved here 7 years ago. The Israeli and Israeli-American community in L.A. is pretty big. I've seen perhaps numbers in the hundreds of thousands. Give us a sense of what Israeli nationals here in L.A. might be experiencing right now.
Yes, I moved here 7 years ago, like you said. I was surprised to hear that there is an Israeli newspaper in Hebrew based in L.A. and more than 300,000 Israelis. And since then, I'm very, you know, working close with them, report about their life, their lifestyle. And like you mentioned a few minutes ago, I woke up this morning and I saw those horrible footage and video of Israeli and Jewish people being attacked in West Hollywood, actually 5 minutes walk from my offices in the Israeli newspaper. So it's actually reflect the feeling right now. There's a lot of tension in the street. A lot of Israelis are stay at home. They worry about being target, and there's a lot of tension, a lot of worries, a lot of questions. And when they don't do that, they basically glue to the television and to the social media platform, trying to understand what's going on in Israel, worry about their families in Israel. And yeah, not a pretty sight and not easy time for Israeli and also Jewish community in LA.
Rilla, you have lived in the U.S. for longer. You grew up in Abu Dhabi, but the community of Palestinians here in Los Angeles is smaller, too, than the Israeli-Americans here. Estimated to be around 15,000. How would you characterize the way that your Palestinian friends and family here are feeling at the moment?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, that's actually the news this morning. It's absolutely abhorrent, and my heart breaks for my Jewish siblings who had to endure that this morning in West Hollywood. I mean, I can't think of anything more abhorrent and revolting. So I'm so sorry to. It's just absolutely abhorrent. In any case, so your question about how do
your Palestinian friends in this country feel about what's happening in the Middle East? Because we see the pictures and it's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. It's heartbreaking on both sides. Nobody wants to see anybody suffering, but this is such a political issue that goes back decades and decades. So. What is the feeling in your community?
Yeah. Like you mentioned, I think it's a cycle of pain, heartbreak, agony. But then there's also some hopefulness and togetherness and support that that we're feeling from, you know, from each other, but more importantly, from folks around the world. It's something we never thought that we'd see in our lifetime, like from rallies across the world, from London, Spain, Yemen, Kuwait, Canada, even to here in the U.S. And even within Israel itself, which is unprecedented, peaceful rallies in places like Haifa, like Nazareth. So it's the cycle, right? And then like Elad mentioned, exactly, like you wake up just checking on your family, on your friends. You're checking the news for how many dead this morning, how many displaced, how many buildings have been destroyed. Just yesterday, we found out the only COVID testing building in Gaza is now destroyed. The library is destroyed. It's more than just dead, right? It's more than just a scoreboard of, hey, how many died here? How many died there? It's absolute devastation, destruction, and it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. But this hopefulness and togetherness that I mentioned, I mean, for the very first time, I've never thought in my lifetime I'd see U.S. Congress members on the House floor bringing to light this absolute, like, brutal Israeli government occupation of Palestine, the inhumane treatment of the indigenous Palestinians within Israel itself. It's something I never thought I'd see. It's something that makes me hopeful, and I'm just thankful for anyone who speaks up. But yeah, it's definitely a cycle.
Elad, there's a split between Israelis and native-born Jewish Americans when it comes to these issues, the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Tell us a little bit about that, because this has split the Jewish community for sure, the Israeli-American community.
It's interesting. Just before that, I would like to add from what you guys just talked about. I mean, I think the social media play a big role of transferring violence from one place to another. And this morning, it's a great example for that. Great, also sad example, because there's so much information and misleading information and false information that travels from what's happening in Israel and in Gaza here. And that makes people be angry and upset and take it to the street sometimes. So I think it's just something that we should talk about and be careful about, because it's what it would do. It's bring in more bloodshed and violence here to America. And we should all be careful about it. And as somebody who works press like myself and as a journalist the last 15 years, I'm also very careful to report only facts and not to put anything in social media to who caused to more violence and bloodshed. Regardless of what your question, yeah, I mean, there's also a big Jewish community here, and There's a gap because the big difference is that every Israeli, most of them, they serve in the army, in the Israeli army. So they know everything from close. Like for myself, I see Israel from the eyes of a citizen who born and raised in Israel, the eyes of an ex-IDF soldier who served my country, and saw Gaza and saw Lebanon and saw all those places in my own eyes. And from a journalist who live abroad right now, and, you know, I criticize Israel so many times, but also I know the truth. And some Jewish American, they're born here. Some of them doesn't speak Hebrew. Most of them didn't serve in the army. So the melting pot that the army create in Israel between all Israelis doesn't exist here. Overall, I believe that everybody wants Israel to be safe, because Israel has been established to be home of all Jewish people. But there is a big gap there. I feel like the Jewish American being torn between support Israel and, you know, be part of American society here and try to say the right thing.
Rella, you are married to a Jewish American woman, but you say the divide that more often opens up, in your experience, is not around religion, it's around politics. This is a political ideology. Explain what you mean about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I have to say, and I hope that this makes it in, anti-Semitism and any toxic ideology like that, that claims to cling on this this political issue, is absolutely abhorrent. And no one in my Palestinian community or family accepts any violence or anti-Semitism that happens here you know, in the name of quote, the cause. That is absolutely awful.
Of course. And you know, I think when you look at this politically, because and I think of the war in Iraq back in 2003, there were so many people who were against in this country against the war in Iraq. You can be an American and love your country and be against the war in Iraq, right? Just like you can be an Israeli who is against what's happening in the Middle East at this moment. And that's, I think, what I was trying to get to with Elad about the fact that, you know, there is such a split in the Israeli-American community. And by the way, among Israelis in Israel as well. And I wonder, what are these conversations happening in your household, being married to a Jewish American woman?
So let me talk about firstly exactly what you said. I think there is a very perpetuated myth out there that this is a race war or like Jews against quote Arabs or anything like this. It is absolutely not. It's inhumane, institutionalized. Suppression of an ethnic minority that's happening over there. And that is why you have the split that's happening in Israel, because on one hand, we have to understand the plight of the Jewish people, right? You understand they've been suffering for decades and hundreds of years. And so you want them to have a place of peace, a place of, you know, somewhere where they can live in peace. We understand that, of course. But I think the split is how that shouldn't come at the cost of oppressing another group of people.
Irala, you spoke about the Israeli government, and very curious, you never mentioned Hamas, who is actually a terror organization recognized here in America as a terror organization.
So they control some of Gaza for sure.
My heart's crying out loud to the Palestinians. I've been to Gaza. I've been to Gaza, and I know what's happened there. I'm not getting my information from social media or from the television. I was there. As a journalist, I was there. So I can tell you that you will see a terror organization who control its people.
Does distance help in this case? I mean, as in, can you and others step back and see it from a different perspective now that you were thousands of miles away? And I'll start with you, Rilla.
That's actually an interesting question. I think it's not necessarily distance, but I think being in the United States helps with perspective. At least in the U.S., when people are speaking up within the U.S., people listen. And so that's what I feel that I need to use my privilege to do.
Elad, what about you here in Los Angeles? Does distance help you in your perspective?
Yes, a lot. And like I said before, now I have the angle of a journalist who live abroad and see my country from far away, 15 hours flight away, to be exact. And, you know, I'm meeting and interviewing a lot of Israeli celebrities here, and I ask them that question a lot. You know, Gal Gadot, known as Wonder Woman, Israeli, born and raised in Israel, serving the Israeli IDF, being super successful. And she got a lot of criticism, for instance, that she was, you know, very mellow and the way she respond to what happened in Israel right now, very diplomatic and didn't support her country. And I understand where she's coming from, because here you see things from different angle. You're more balanced, you're more, you're trying to see the other side. And I really feel that on top of the pain that I feel, especially in a morning like this, hearing what happened in Melrose in West Hollywood, yes, I think I'm more balanced. I think I'm more willing to listen to the other side. Always willing to sit and talk with Palestinians, with Arab people from Israel and from around the world, and to hear the pain, to hear how we can make things better. Because, you know, people ask me, Elad, what did you learn serving in the army for 4 years? You know what I learned? I learned that we don't want war anymore. Mm-hmm. We're tired from war. We're tired. We lost way too many people. So yeah, being here, I really hope that I can help bring also good stories about the Jewish people, about Israel, and good news, and not just news like we heard today and the past week.
I want to thank you both for talking to us today. Elad Masuri, an Israeli journalist based here in L.A., and Rola Selbach, filmmaker of Palestinian descent here in Los Angeles as well. Thank you to you both, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin comes on to talk about his proposal to make parking lots and even park areas as temporary homes for people experiencing homelessness. It's not going over well in some places. You're going to hear it tomorrow. A reminder that KCRW's Drive to the Future goes on. We're in the final stretch, just a few more days, but we still have a long way to go. We're asking you to give now. You know, it's not easy wrangling newsmakers and reporters and the idiosyncrasies of a major metropolitan area every day for a daily show. There is a lot that goes into it, a lot of talented people, a lot of technology. That costs money. Help us finance the coverage that you expect on KCRW. KCRW.com/give. And thank you for your support. Catherine Barnes, Nihar Patel, Jenna Cagle, Michael Stark, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show. Thank you for your ears and attention tonight. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great night.